Good evening. This is our 32nd class in Derech Hashem, and we left off last week with some pressing questions about angels and stars, and so we're going to pick up with that. So we had some questions. I'll tell you the ones we left off with last week. Why does Hashem need stars and angels at all? Why did he create them? Why does he have to resort to angels to carry out his commands? How can stars have souls? So we're going to see that, too. Why does the chain of transmission include angels, stars, and man? So what is the point of that? So I actually have quite a bit to look at tonight. I think we're going to start in Arya Kaplan's book, Immortality, Resurrection, and the Age of the Universe, again, and look at some of these questions. So the first question that we want to examine, which has to do with our Derech Hashem, is stars. So this chapter in Derech Hashem is the influence of the stars. It's a short chapter, but has a lot of information, or it alludes to a lot of information. And I think it's important for us as Makarvos to have more of an understanding of this information, if not to be fluent in it, but to at least know that this information exists. Okay, so let's start with this. Why are the stars necessary in the link between God and man? And why does the chain include angel, star, and man? So let's just review from last week a little bit, that the stars are the last switching station, so to speak, the last energy transference station from Hashem to this earth that makes things manifest. So we do have a strong flow of energy that comes from the stars and manifests itself here on earth. So if that's the case, then what's the story with angels? We understand that malachim have that nothing happens without a malach touching it and saying it should happen. So we have this understanding that every blade of grass, a malach doesn't grow unless a malach hits it and says grow. So where do the stars fit in with that then? And how many malachim are there anyway? So it turns out there's a lot. So let's talk about what malachim are for just a minute. So malachim are the interface of energy between Hashem and us, that the thoughts made manifest are basically a way that you could think about malachim. I've used in the past the mashal of spiritual neurotransmitters. So neurotransmitters being that chemical in our bodies that brings the idea through our nerves into activity. So if I have an itch on my cheek and I first perceive that, so itch goes through cheek to nerves to brain that says itch, and then brain makes a decision, scratch, and then neurotransmitters take that information, scratch, down to my fingertips, which brings my hand up to my face, and then I can scratch. So that the message is transmitted. The thing is made to happen via neurotransmitters. And that's basically how malachim work. Hashem thinks, so to speak, and sets off the transmission of his information through malachim on different levels, through the stars also, as we'll see, until it's manifest on earth. And it actually happens, comes into reality. But why is that necessary? So Arya Kaplan explains in his book, Immortality, Resurrection, the Age of the Universe, in his chapter on astrology, stars and angels, that it's not possible, as you know, to think about Hashem in any way except for one wholeness, Shlemut. Of course, we do think of Hashem broken up into pieces in a way. We think of Hashem's anger as separate from his compassion, as separate from his running the world, as separate from his judging the world. So that's just because of our limitations, our human makeup. We are separate in those things. And so we can only really see the world through our lenses. Even Hashem, we can only see through our lenses. So because we're so fragmented, it's hard for us to even think about, let alone see, so to speak, Hashem, as the simple unity that Hashem is. And yet Hashem is absolutely simple, absolutely perfectly one. There is no plurality at all within Hashem. So it's not possible for Hashem to be separated out into different components. So then, if that's the case, how then does Hashem relate to two people at the same time, or a million people at the same time, or a billion people at the same time, or even more? How is it possible that Hashem can run all the different things that he runs when he's totally simply unified into one? So, of course, that's the question that as human beings we can't really understand the answer to. However, our Kabbalists do tell us that one of the ways that he did that was by creating a system of malachim, a system of angels that are his interface. So angels can be fragmented, meaning each angel can take care of one task. There can be a multiplicity of angels that all stem from the singularity of Hashem. So a way for Hashem to not himself become fragmented, but to fragment his energy, his emanations, is through a chain of angelic forces. So that is the creation of angels, is to carry out Hashem's commands, to carry out Hashem's will, because they can be fragmented in a way that we can't say can't about Hashem, but in a way that Hashem is not fragmented. Okay, so if we have malachim to do every little thing, so then how does that work? How does that have to do with what we're discussing? So first let's look at these malachim. It's a question. When Arya Kaplan asks, when were these malachim created? On what day of creation? And it seems to be controversy within some of the sources. Some say on the second day of creation, when the initial aspect of Shemayim was created. And some say on the fifth day of creation, when Shemayim was populated. So, and then some say both. So how does the both work? Well, there's two different types of malachim. There are malachim with names, and there are malachim without names. So the malachim without names were created apparently on the second day, and the malachim with names were created only on the fifth day. So what is the difference between these two types of malachim? So we definitely have the concept, I'm sure most people are familiar with, that it's not possible for a malach to have more than one task. So we know that, for instance, the three malachim that visited Abraham after his birth, each one had its own task, one to tell about the destruction of Sodom, one to heal him, and one to bring the news that he's going to have a son. I'm trying to think if there was a fourth task. I think there's a fourth task there, and so there's a question. If a malach can only have one, so how did one malach do two tasks? Because I think the one who brought the news about having a son is the one who then went on to save Lot. That was it. That was the fourth task. How could he have two? It's one malach. So he completed one task and then went on to the other one. So that's a question. How can a malach complete one task and then go on to another one? Now, humorously, in our family, we have a tradition from my husband's grandfather. It's not a real tradition, but he would say that the malach that's in charge of shofar blowing, what does he do all year long, right? You only blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and the whole rest of the year, what is he doing? So my grandfather-in-law, used to say that the rest of the year, that malach is the one that's in charge of chilant for the whole year. So the whole year he's in charge of chilant, Rosh Hashanah is in charge of shofar blowing. Okay, that's cute, and it works, actually, if you're saying there's a single task per malach, but a malach could maybe do consecutive singular tasks. For instance, bringing news and then saving Lot, or watching over shofar blowing and then watching over chilant. But how does that work? If a malach is really only supposed to have one task, how could a malach have more than one task? So the question is really deepened by the definition of a malach. So once we understand what a malach is, we understand that it is only possible for them to have one task, and yet the conundrum of multiple tasks will remain. In order to understand how they can only have one task, let's start by looking in the Rambam, Hilchot Yesodei Torah. Which parak is this? It's the second parak, halacha, number 5, halacha hey and vav, we're going to look at. I'll read it to you in English. Since they, he's talking here about malachim, the whole chapter is about malachim here, since the malachim possess no body, what separates the form of the malachim from each other? Their existence is not alike. Rather, each one is below the level of the other and exists by virtue of its influence in a progression of levels, one above the other. Okay, so the Rambam is asking here, how can you tell if malachim are spiritual beings, How are they not all blended in one with another? How can you tell the difference between them? I mean, with human beings, you can tell the difference because we have different physical forms, but malachim are not physical at all. So how can you differentiate from one malach to another? How do they not blend? How are they not all exactly the same? Are all grass malachim exactly the same? They all, each one has a job of striking a blade of grass. Do they all look the same? How could they be different from another? How can we tell? So what he's answering is that their existence is not alike. Each one has its own level, and each one exists by virtue of the influence that it exerts in its level. So back into the text of the Rambam, everything exists by virtue of the influence of the Holy One, blessed be He, and His goodness. Solomon alluded to this concept in his wisdom, saying in Kohelet, because above the one who is high, there is a watcher, and there are others higher than them. Okay, so that's a pasuk in Kohelet 5:7, but it's talking about levels. So let's see halacha vav, what the levels are. So the expression below the level of the other does not refer to height in a spatial sense, as one might say he is sitting higher than his colleague, but rather in regard to spiritual level. For example, when speaking about two sages, one of whom is greater than the other, we say one is above the level of the other. Similarly, a cause is referred to as above the effect that it produces. So just like when we talk about people or scholars or Talmidei Chachamim, we can say one is greater than the other, so one is bigger than the other, even if physically that's not manifest, or one is above the other. So what does that mean, one is above? It doesn't mean literally above. One's not hovering and one's not walking below that person. That's not what it is. When we talk about above and below, we're talking about spiritual stature, talking about intellectual stature, and we're talking about something that can't actually be measured in height. So you can't say really above and below, and yet we do. So it has to do with the influence that one exerts. One is above another when the influence that they exert is stronger. So even, let's say, in a job, the boss is above the employee, right? The boss is the manager is above the managed because they exert an influence that's felt below. So malachim are divided into aboves and belows depending on the influence that they exert. So with that, if we understand that the entire way that they're differentiated is by the influence that they exert, so the fact that they're differentiated that way, it's tied to their influence, means they can only have that influence. That's how they are defined. Let's look back in the text of Arya Kaplan. Okay, now we're going to make it more difficult. Okay, the Kaplists discuss this. So we talked about angels that are created on the second day, the fifth day, some say both. So the Kabbalists also discuss this, and many of them propose an interesting distinction. They state that there are two kinds of angels, permanent ones and temporary ones. The temporary angels are created on the second day, the permanent ones, which are likened to the birds, on the fifth. Moreover, only the permanent ones have names. The most important factors in astrology are the time and date of a person's birth. According to the Talmud, there is a mazal of the hour. In other words, the time of day and date upon which a person is born have an important influence on his destiny. Okay, so we'll see how that plays in, because we're talking about the influence of the stars here. So each mazal, each star, each flow through of energy, each mazal, exerts an influence on a particular day, on a particular hour. Let's just look at the week for a minute. I do not understand how all of this works. I'm just telling you some things that I learned, not so much for us to understand it, but to know that it's there in Yiddishkeit and to have heard about it. And then you can do your own research if you want to find out more about it, but it is important for us to just lay down a layer of information to understand that it does exist within Yiddishkeit. Okay, so the days of the week, each one has its own, in this case I'm going to say planet, even though I'll contradict myself in a minute. Each day of the week has its own planet that exerts a particular influence over that day. The first day of the week, Sunday, is ruled by the sun, or most highly influenced by the sun. So that's a star. But in this discussion, it's a heavenly body. So we're not differentiating between stars and planets in a scientific level. We're talking about heavenly bodies and the influence that they exert on a spiritual level. So in this case, the sun counts as a planet or that heavenly body that exerts influence. The next day, Monday, the dominant influence is through the moon. Tuesday, the dominant influence is through Mars. Wednesday, it's through Mercury. Thursday, through Jupiter. Friday, through Venus. And Saturday, Shabbos, Saturn. This is a Jewish concept, that each of these different influences dominate a particular day. And then each hour also has its particular dominance. And it depends on if the hour is in the daylight hours or in the nighttime hours. You know, the day is divided into 12 daytime hours and 12 nighttime hours. So I don't really understand how this works. So I'm not going to try to explain it, but I just want you to understand that there is such a thing as an interface of the influence that's exerted on the day and the influence that's exerted by the hour. Sort of like, for anybody who understands sphera and how sphera works, each week has a dominant influence of a particular sphere, and each day within each week has a particular influence. So that when you get to the week, let's say, of Chesed, so Chesed Sheva Chesed is the first day, and the fourth day would be Netzach Sheva Chesed. Right? So there would be the influence of Netzach within the realm of Chesed. So the same thing, in a way, is what's happening during the day. You'd have the influence of Mercury during the major influence of the sun, depending on the hour in the day. So with that in mind, let's just go a little bit further and ask another question, complicating question. So we've established that the definition of a malach is that it is defined by its mission, so it can only have one mission, because if it would have more than one mission, it would be defined differently. So it's the very definition of a malach is the one missionness. And yet, now we have a conundrum, because somewhere in the Gemara, I believe that it's in Gemara Nida, it says that there's a malach called Lila who oversees birth. And this is the malach who announces whether the newborn person will be strong or weak, wise or foolish, rich or poor. That is in Gemara Nida 16b, if anybody wants to look it up. So some commentators ask a serious question in this regard. I'm reading from Ari Kaplan. The Medrash states, one angel cannot have two missions, and two angels cannot share the same mission. That's in Bereishit Rabbah 52. In the light of this important rule, which teaches us many things about the spiritual realm in general, how can a single angel oversee the birth of every individual who is ever born and who will ever be born? Does it mean that that angel who does so has many missions? Before we can answer this question, we must first explore its logic. Why is it that one angel cannot have two missions? Why can't two angels share the same mission? So that's the answer to that lies in the Rambam that I read to you earlier. So the Rambam, I'll just read what he says about how he reviews the Rambam. The answer, says the Rambam, is that angels are mostly differentiated by level. In the chain of cause and effect, one angel is higher or lower than the other, and in this respect, one is closer to Hashem, while another may be further away from him. It is in this way that they are differentiated. In another passage, however, the Rambam discusses another way that spiritual beings like angels can be differentiated. All spiritual entities, angels included, are associated with physical things. Differentiating them is made possible by the fact that each of them is associated with a different physical object. Thus, for example, every blade of grass has its own angel. Each blade of grass is different, and so is each angel. Analogously, human souls are differentiated because they, too, are associated with different physical bodies. So if you think about it, our souls are spiritual entities, as are malachim. How are our souls differentiated one from another? It's upstairs, honey. It's not here. For sure. How are souls differentiated one from another? It's through the attachment to the physical body. Ultimately, I think we discussed before in this class, although I don't remember clearly, ultimately all our souls will return to the oneness from which they came as they lose the differentiation of association with the physical self. So we did speak about this, I think, as we talked about reincarnation and resurrection and initial voyaging into the next world. As we disassociate further and further from the physical levush that we wear, we lose the personality that we have that is associated with the physical levush that we wore, and ultimately blend into a unity. That has to do with Kol Yisrael Aravim Zelazeh. We're all mixed in one with another, and ultimately we will all be mixed in one with another, which, by the way, is why we do Kiruv, because we are all each other in the end, and we really care, not just care about each other, but care how each one of us interacts with Hashem and fulfills their role in the world. We want all of us to be able to maximize their potential, because we are all each other. Okay, back to the text, Ari Kaplan. Okay, so if we're looking at angels as differentiated by the missions that they have or the physical thing to which they are bonded, then we understand that if they're bonded to one particular physical thing, they can't possibly share a mission or have two missions. Otherwise, they'd no longer be differentiated. Okay, skipping down in his text. This is a very important principle. Spiritual entities, like angels, are primarily differentiated by virtue of their association with physical objects or actions. So physical objects or actions, the influence that they exert, their action, or the object, the blade of grass, whichever one they're associated with, that's what differentiates them. We therefore have a one-to-one ratio between angels and their physical counterparts. Now let's get back to our angel called Lila, the angel who oversees conception. This angel has overseen every conception that's ever taken place and will continue to do so for every future conception. But how can it get by without violating the rule that one angel has only one mission on the one-to-one rule? Of course, the same question applies to all the angels that have names. There are angels that exist forever, the ones created on the fifth day. In the course of their existence, they have many tasks and missions. We know that the angels Michael and Gabriel have many tasks. Why does the rule not hold true with regard to them? This question is raised by Rabbeinu Bachya, and he says that as long as the tasks are not radically different, one angel can have more than one mission. However, he does not explain why. So we still have to answer the important question. If a single angel has many tasks, why is it not differentiated by these tasks into many angels? How can it remain a single entity? It appears that our question is answered by Rabbi Yitzchak Abarbanel, who writes that the angels are like souls to the stars. Let me tell you where he writes that. That's Abarbanel on Devarim 18:24, and see also the Perush on Yad Yisodei HaTorah 2:5, which is what we read before. Not the Perush, but the actual Yisodei HaTorah. Okay, so since the human soul is also a spiritual entity, we might well ask the same question about it. How can we be involved with so many tasks? How can our soul, a single soul, be involved in so many tasks? Why is it not differentiated into many souls by all its tasks? But the answer here is obvious. It is integrated by its physical body. As long as the soul is associated with a single body, it can do many different things, as many different things as it pleases. Its association with the body allows it to remain an integrated whole while doing differentiated tasks. So this is what the Abarbanel is explaining about Malachim, the named Malachim, being souls to the stars. that once they're attached to a star, then the star, the physical entity of the star, integrates the spirituality of the malach and allows it to differentiate by task, because the attachment to the physical brings it into a oneness, anchors it in a way. Let's look further, because this is a complicated concept. This is where there's a one-to-one relationship with named angels. Each star has its own particular angel, and each angel has its own star. This relationship allows the named angels to have many tasks and not be differentiated by them, for each named angel is integrated by the star that serves as its body. It is now possible to explain why the permanent angels have names. The Zohar teaches that every single star in the universe has a name. This is derived from the verse, "He brings out their host by number, he calls them all by name." That's in Yeshayahu 40:26. It is also written, "He counts the number of the stars, he gives them each a name," in Tehillim 147:4. The Midrash indicates that the different names of the stars correspond to the names of the different malachim. Here again, we have the one-to-one relationship. Earlier, we mentioned that the named malachim were created on the fifth day, whereas the unnamed, temporary malachim were created on the second. This circumstance can now be explained. The named malachim had to be associated with the stars, and therefore could not be created until after the stars. Since the stars were not created until the fourth day, the angels could not be created until the fifth. It's interesting just to think about also the purpose for on the second day, why Hashem would have created them on the second day, the temporary ones, in terms of the interface between his will and making things manifest. He would have already desired their presence by the second day to start differentiating things and making things manifest in the world. But that could be single-tasked malachim rather than the malachim with longevity. Okay, this also sheds light on the whole subject of astrology. So the whole purpose of this whole discussion is now coming to a culmination. As discussed earlier in this essay, one of the important questions pertaining to astrology asks why the stars form a part of the chain between God and man. As we now see, one reason for this is because the stars are necessary so that the angels can have many tasks and still maintain their identity. Another question asks how angels interact with each other. And here we encounter the same difficulties as in the question about the differentiation of angels. We know, however, that angels interact with each other in planning future events, and indeed that this is an important part of their task. Apparently, the relationships between the various stars and planets are involved as well. Especially important is the way they appear when viewed from the Earth, since this is the focus of their activity. The way the astronomical bodies are arrayed in our line of sight seems to be a major factor in the interaction. In the final analysis, then, astrology can offer some important insights into Jewish theology. At first, it may be somewhat difficult to understand how the stars have the power to influence man. But as we probe more deeply into our classical texts, these questions open many other doors and enable us to understand other concepts more deeply. Okay, so the principles that he's bringing out, let's just review, is that, well, let's attach it to something we discussed much earlier, that in the one of the principal differences between the spiritual world and the physical world is that the physical world has space, has distance, has a spatial relationship with one object to another, whereas the spiritual world has no space. And so there is, it's more difficult for us to consider relationships one to another in the spiritual world. In the spiritual world, if things are polar opposites, let's say the Yetzer Tov and the Yetzer Hara, then they can't ever exist together. And yet, we human beings know that they happen to exist quite nicely together inside ourselves. We have both a Yetzer Tov and a Yetzer Hara, but that's because we're physical, and the two together can converge in the physical. I'll remind you back several classes where we talked about the physical. I think it was a class I gave in January from the AJAP conference, where we talked about Arya Kaplan discussing a triangular concept, or I guess it's my image is the triangular, but if you think about an inverted isosceles triangle with the point at the bottom and the two and the base on the top. So in the spiritual realm, you could have two things that are far apart, let's say Hashem and our souls. Right? They're far apart from each other. Our souls, once they're disconnected from Hashem, are not Hashem and are not as excellent or as pure or as unified as Hashem, so they can't exist on the same realm at all. And yet Hashem's desire is for our souls to come close to Him. But it's not possible for two things that are so different to become close in the spiritual world. Closeness in the spiritual world is not measured by space or distance between them, physical distance, but rather it's measured by similarity, how similar one thing is to another. So our souls are very distant to Hashem, and yet Hashem's desire is that they become close. So that is the purpose of the physical realm. That bottom point on the triangle unites the two so that a mitzvah, a physical activity, can then unite Hashem and the Jewish soul, where both of them focus their energy downward and are united at the point, united through the mitzvah. So the purpose of a mitzvah is to bond together the physical, to use the physical to bond together the spiritual, to bond our spiritual selves with Hashem. But we can only do that through a physical point, because in the physical world you can physically push together, force together things that are opposites. Excuse me. So the physical world can be used for bringing things close together that can't be close together in the spiritual world. So that is one of the reasons for the physical world, and it's one of the reasons for mitzvot, is to have a realm in which those things that are distant can be brought together. And so if you can take from the spiritual world, bring them together into the physical world, then they can emanate back up in a together way rather than in a separated way. So Arya Kaplan discusses that further in his book on Tefillin, NCSY book, page 42. I'll read you just a little bit of what he has to say here. Okay, I'm starting in the middle of his essay, so I'll just start with a dot, dot, dot. If we cannot draw close to Hashem through such spiritual exercises as meditation and contemplation, how can we do it through a mere physical act, such as wearing tefillin? In order to understand this, we must ask another simple but profound question. Why did God create the physical world? This is a really difficult question. God Himself is certainly spiritual, and so is the good that He has to give. The entire purpose of creation is essentially spiritual in scope. Then what necessity was there in creating a physical world at all? In order to answer this question, we must still ask another question. What is the difference between the spiritual and the physical? We speak of the two concepts, the spiritual and the physical, and realize that there is a difference between the two. But precisely, what is it? So this is what we discussed in terms of space. Let's see if I can go a little further. Actually, I think this is what we described outside, so we don't need to read it inside. Basically, what he's saying is that the reason why tefillin have to be so, there's so many diukim in tefillin, so many halachot, that even if there's one little letter that's incorrectly written inside the parchment, inside the box, that nobody can even see, it still makes a difference, because it all has to be exactly reminiscent of Hashem's tefillin, whatever that means, that it's the fine-tuning of the physical instrument has to be such that it represents physically that which Hashem has, and when we wear it, we can enter through the physical zone into the spiritual reality of connection with Hashem. And he gives actually a nice analogy for tefillin, which works for other mitzvot too, of a radio. A radio is see if I can find Matt Mushell because he writes it nicely. He's a scientist, and I am not. So it works out nicely the way he says it. A radio is specifically designed to receive a particular type of signal. Every element in it is needed for this. Cut a single wire, remove a single capacitor, no matter how small, and you will no longer receive the signal. There are precise rules by which a radio must be built. These include all the laws of electromagnetism and circuits. If these are not exactly followed, the radio will not function. Tefillin are our receiver for a spiritual signal. As such, they must be designed to receive this particular kind of signal. Violate a single rule and they become like a radio with a transistor removed. The bond just no longer exists. We can carry the analogy still further. You would have to have an extensive scientific education to even begin to understand how a radio works. You would have to know calculus and differential equations and all the complexities of electromagnetic theory. But still, even the youngest child can turn on a radio. The same is true of mitzvos. A lifetime study might lead you to begin to understand their significance, but anyone can put them on and receive the signal. Okay, that's Arya Kaplan in that. I want to share, before we move away from the subject of the influence of the stars, I just want to share a piece of Gemara. It's in Masechet Shabbos, 156, Amud Aleph. And I'm going to read to you in English. I did not study this. I do not know what it means. I'm just going to read to you, just so you can hear some of the things that we were talking about before, some of the influences that they have. The reason why I'm just cautioning, I didn't learn this, A, because it's true, but B, because it's important for us to understand, and I'm sure everybody knows on this call, but just to reiterate, that the Gemara is the container for information. It is prompts for discussion, but it itself doesn't always have the information. It's encoded. So just because I'm going to read this doesn't mean that all of this is necessarily the case. It means that one needs to sit with a teacher and learn from this text how to actually understand the ideas that are contained in it. So let me just read some of this. Okay. Rav Chanina then said to his disciples, "Go out and tell the son of Levi, not the constellation of the day." Oh, wait, I'll start one paragraph earlier. It was recorded in Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi's notebook. "He who is born on the first day of the week shall be a man without one thing in him." What does "without one thing in him" mean? Shall we say he's without one virtue? Surely, Rav Ashi said, "I was born on the first day of the week. Hence, it must surely mean one vice." But surely, Rav Ashi said, "I and Dimi ben Kutzka were born on the first day of the week. I am a king, and he is the captain of thieves." Rather, it means either completely virtuous or completely wicked. What is the reason? Because light and darkness were created on that day. He who is born on the second day of the week will be bad-tempered. What is the reason? Because the waters were divided thereon. He who is born on the third day of the week will be wealthy and unchaste. What is the reason? Because herbs were created thereon. He who is born on the fourth day of the week will be wise and of a retentive memory. What is the reason? Because the luminaries were suspended thereon. He who is born on the fifth day of the week will practice benevolence. What is the reason? Because the fishes and the birds are created thereon. He who is born on the eve of the Sabbath will be a seeker. Rav Nachman ben Yitzchak commented, "A seeker after good deeds." He who is born on Shabbat will die on Shabbat, because the great day of Shabbat was desecrated on his account. Rabbah, son of Shelah, observed, "And he shall be a great and holy man." Rav Chanina said to them, his disciples, "Go out and tell the son of Levi, not the constellation of the day, but that the hour is the determining influence. He who is born under the constellation of the sun will be a distinguished man. He will eat and drink of his own, and his secrets will lie uncovered. If a thief, he will have no success. He who is born under Venus will be wealthy and unchaste." What is the reason? "Because fire was created therein. He who is born under Mercury will be of a retentive memory and wise. What is the reason? Because Mercury is the sun's scribe. He who is born under the moon will be a man to suffer evil, building and demolishing, demolishing and building, eating and drinking that which is not his, and his secrets will remain hidden. If a thief, he will be successful. He who is born under Saturn will be a man whose plans will be frustrated. Others say all nefarious designs against him will be frustrated. He who is born under Tzedek, Jupiter, will be a right-doing man, a Tzadkan. Rabbi Nachman ben Yitzchak observed right-doing and good deeds. He who is born under Mars will be a shedder of blood. Rav Ashi observed either a surgeon, a thief, a slaughterer, or a circumciser. Rabba said, I was born under Mars. Abaye retorted, you too inflict punishment and kill. Okay, I think that's enough. There's more. There's a few more paragraphs about the influence of the stars on the nature of a person. I guess I should probably read this following paragraph because this is where it says Ein Mazal B'Yisrael so many times. So let me just read this. But there's even more on the next page, but I'll read you this paragraph. It was stated, Rav Hanina said, the planetary influence gives wisdom. The planetary influence gives wealth. And Israel stands under planetary influence. Rabbi Yochanan maintained, Israel is immune from planetary influence. Ein Mazal Yisrael. Now Rabbi Yochanan is consistent with this view. For Rabbi Yochanan said, how do we know that Israel is immune from planetary influence? Because it is said, thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the nations, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the nations are dismayed at them, and they are dismayed, but not Israel. Rav, too, holds that Israel is immune from planetary influence. For Rabbi Yehuda said in Rav's name, how do we know that Israel is immune from planetary influence? Because it is said, and he brought him forth from abroad. Avraham pleaded before the Holy One, blessed be he, Master of the universe, one born in mine house is mine heir. Not so, he replied, but he that will come forth from thine own bowels, thine own loins. Master of the universe, he cried, I have looked at my constellation and find that I am not fated to beget child. Go forth from, i.e., cease from, thy planet, for Israel is free of planetary influence. What is thy calculation? So we read this last week, the Rashi on that pasuk, which says, Ein Mazal Yisrael. Anyway, so this is in Gemara Shabbos, 156a and B. I guess about a third down of A, and then probably the first third of B. If you want to learn that, perhaps with your husband or somebody else, to gain a drop of insight into this, but it certainly is something that we have as a strong tradition in Yiddishkeit. Okay, I think that's probably enough for tonight. Let me just review and make sure I covered what I wanted to cover. Let's see, why does Hashem need stars and angels? We talked about why does he have to resort to the angels to carry out his commands. We talked about how can stars have souls. We discussed. And so we looked through the Derech Hashem and immortality, resurrection, age of the universe. We looked at the Rambam, we looked at the Gemara, and I think that brings us to a close for tonight. So I want to bench everyone that they have an easy and extremely meaningful fast this coming up week. Hopefully we won't even have to fast. You know, one of my favorite brachas that occasionally have gotten from a mashulach when they've come to the door is that we should have a fleshiga tisha b'av. And this year we are going to have a fleshiga tisha b'av. Of course the hope is that it will be fleshig because it will be a yantif and we'll be celebrating. This year it's Shabbos, which pushes off Tisha B'av. So even though it's Tisha B'av, we will still have Shabbos and we'll still have fleshigs on Tisha B'av. But Bezrat Hashem, it'll be the fleshiks of celebration that there is no fast the next day, that Mashiach is here, and it's time for us to come together and witness that redemption. So Bezrat Hashem will have a fleshik of Simcha, and if not, may our fast be extremely productive in separating the negativity from us and from Klal Yisrael so that we can move quickly towards that day when there'll be no more fasting and no more tears and and no more struggles, and we'll be able to all grow in spirituality together. Kol Tov, have a great week.